This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'm Aviva Tuffield and I'm the Executive Director of the Stella Prize, and we're going to be having a sort of wide-ranging discussion celebrating the Stella Prize. At the far end is Alice Pung. Alice was a judge of the 2016 Stella Prize. She's a writer, editor, teacher and lawyer whose debut novel, Lorinda, was longlisted for the 2015 Stella Prize. Her previous books include Unpolished Gem, Her Father's Daughter, and she's the editor of the anthology Growing Up Asian in Australia. Next to Alice is Peggy Frew. Peggy Frew's second novel, Hope Farm, was shortlisted for this year's Stella Prize and is currently longlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. Her previous novel, her debut novel, House of Sticks, won the 2010 Victorian Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Prize, a literary award for an unpublished manuscript, and her story Home Visit won the Age Short Story Prize. And then immediately to my left is Charlotte Wood, who is the author of 5 novels and a book of nonfiction. She was the editor of a short story anthology, Brothers and Sisters, and for 3 years she edited the Writer's Room Interviews magazine. Her previous novels have been shortlisted for numerous awards. Her latest novel, The Natural Way of Things, and she's stolen my copy, so Charlotte, hold your copy up, please. Won the 2016 Indie Book of the Year Award, was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Award, is currently longlisted for the Miles Franklin, and most importantly for our purposes here tonight, is the winner of this year's Stella Prize. Congratulations, Charlotte. So a warm welcome to all our guests. I thought we'd start with both of the 2016 Stella Prize writers telling us a little bit about their books and reading a short passage from them. So I'm going to ask Peggy if you would talk first.
Okay, I was just saying to Aviva back there that I hate doing this because, you know, it took me years and this many pages to say what I wanted to say in this book. And so it's very hard to kind of do a little soundbite. But anyway, I'll give it my best shot. And stop me if I go on for too long. Okay, so Hope Farm is the story of Silver, who's a 13-year-old girl who's led a very nomadic life throughout her early childhood, moving from commune to group house to ashram around Brisbane and Queensland with her single mother, Ishtar. And in 1985, Ishtar meets a new fella, which is something that she does quite often. And Silver and Ishtar move together with this new bloke down to freezing cold Victoria to Hope Farm, which is a hippie commune established in the 70s, but by the mid-80s it's seen better days. And while they're there, their relationship is sort of pushed to a point of crisis, and it already was quite an ambivalent relationship to start with. Perhaps I'll just read a little bit just from early on in the book. So I don't think there's anything else I need to tell you. They've just arrived at Hope, as they call the commune, Hope Farm. And there's a reference to a little girl called Jindy. Jindy's 5 years old. The residents were as you'd expect, long-haired, worn-looking, with bad teeth. There were around 8 or 10 adults, most of them women, and most disappointing of all Hope's disappointments, no children, other than Willow's screaming baby and disgusting, snotty, close-breathing Jindy. "When we get our own crops going again," the women would say, seated at the kitchen table, passing a joint, "we won't have to worry about all that." All that being either bosses or the dole office, because those of them that weren't on some kind of benefits worked picking fruit or vegetables for local farmers or in the nearby powdered milk factory. They would nod vaguely towards the window, the darkening paddocks outside. "Feed ourselves then, like we used to." The hollow, automatic quality to their voices reminded me of doing the chants in the ashrams, sitting cross-legged on the floor. I watched Ishtar sometimes, from a place up on the hill behind the buildings where there was a huge fallen tree I could lean against, hunched in my jacket. Even though I had resolved never again to be drawn in by her fervour, the brightness to her movements as she came and went, raking, chopping, sweeping, pegging out loads of washing, every now and then I was struck by a kind of unwilling wonder. From her figure there below, a current seemed to rise through the chill air, to fan out warmly, indiscriminately, stirring the leaves of the clotted ivy that covered the outdoor toilet, the straw of the chicken coop, the ruined vegetable garden, skating up the sodden grass of the hill and, in passing, filling me with shivers. One evening, I sat watching as she went along the back wall of the house, stooping to pull the lanky weeds that lapped at its base. Beyond, the rust-pocked, wheezing cars were slipping one by one down the track with their loads of potato pickers and factory hands. The heavy sky was darkening, but just as Ishtar threw the last weed onto the pile, there was a shift low on the horizon and a swathe of watery greenish-blue appeared, and the unexpected edge of a platinum sunset sent everything shining. The kitchen window blazed, and below it the wall met the ground unhampered, seeming to shout its illuminated glory, the simple beauty of a clean line. Ishtar caught the weed pile with a garden fork and tossed it in one swift, elegant movement into a wheelbarrow, just as a returned worker came past on his way to the mud brick building. The worker said something, and Ishtar put back her head in a laugh that seemed to puncture the clouds above, the light catching her long throat, and I throbbed with reluctant pride. She was amazing. She could gild the edges of even miserable, freezing, grey hope.
And Charlotte, could you in a few words sort of sum up the natural way of things and then give us a flavour?
Sure. Beautifully read, Peggy. Hard act to follow. My book is about a bunch of young women who wake up from a sort of drugged state to find themselves in a place far from home in the middle of nowhere, and they don't know where it is, but it's in Australia, in a sort of broken down farm. It was very interesting finishing Hope Farm this afternoon. It was actually quite a lot of parallels, I thought. But my girls are there. They realise quite quickly that the thing that unites them all is that they've each been involved in a different scandal with a powerful man or group of men. And this is a prison, and they are there to be punished for speaking out about what had happened to them. And the place is run by a couple of pretty horrible male guards and a nurse, a so-called nurse called Nancy, who turns out has no nursing qualifications whatsoever. And yeah, it's the story of what happens to these girls, and there's a sort of mysterious company called Harding's International that runs this place. So I'll just read from the very beginning, which is about one of the girls, Yolanda, who's one of the two main characters. I'm trying to work out if there's much swearing in this bit. Any children in the room? The American edition took out a lot of swearing. It's quite funny.
So prudish.
And smoking. So there were kookaburras here. This was the first thing Yolanda knew in the dark morning. That and where's my durries? Two birds breaking out in that loose, sharp cackle. A bird call before the sun was up, loud and lunatic. She got out of the bed and felt gritty boards beneath her feet. There was the coarse, unfamiliar fabric of a nightdress on her skin. Who had put this on her? She stepped across the dry wooden floorboards and stood, craning her neck to see through the high, narrow space of a small window. The two streetlights she had seen in her dream turned out to be two enormous stars in the deep blue sky. The kookaburras dazzled the darkness with their horrible noise. Later, there would be other birds. Sometimes she would ask about them, but questions made people suspicious and they wouldn't answer her. She would begin to make up her own names for the birds, the waterfall birds whose calls fell tumbling, and the squeakers, the tiny darting grey ones. Who would have known there would be so many birds in the middle of absolutely fucking nowhere? But that would all come later. Here on this first morning, before everything began, she stared up at the sky as the blue night lightened and listened to the kookaburras and thought, oh yes, you are right. She had been delivered to an asylum. She groped her way along the walls to a door, but there was no handle. She felt at its edge with her fingernails, locked. She climbed back into the bed and pulled the sheet and blanket up to her neck. Perhaps they were right. Perhaps she was mad and all would be well. She knew she was not mad, but all lunatics thought that. When they were small, she and Darren had once collected mounds of moss from under the tap at the back of the flats in the dark, dank corner of the yard where it was always cool, even on the hottest days. They prized up the clumps of moss, the earth heavy in their fingers, and it was a satisfying job, lifting a corner and being careful not to crack the lump, getting better as they went at not splitting the moss and pulling it to pieces. They filled a crackled orange plastic bucket with the moss and took it out to the verge on the street to sell. "Moss for sale," they screamed at the hot cars going by, giggling and gesturing and clowning. "And would you like to buy some moss?" more politely if a man or woman walked past. Nobody bought any moss, even when they spread it beautifully along the verge and Darren sent Yolanda back twice for water to pour over it to keep it springy to the touch. Then they got too hot and Darren left her sitting on the verge while he went and fetched two cups of water, but still nobody bought any moss. So they climbed the stairs and went inside to watch TV, and the moss dried out and turned grey and dusty and died. This was what the nightdress made her think of, the dead moss. And she loved Darren even though she knew it was him who let them bring her here, wherever she was. Perhaps he had put her in the crazed orange bucket and brought her here himself. What she really needed was a ciggy.
So, Alice, you were one of the five judges who had the unenviable task of going through more than 170 books to come up with a long list and then a short list and a winner. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was the judges saw in these two books and what you were looking for and how you came to your decisions?
Sure. So, you know, I'm one of five judges, so I can only speak as myself, and I can speak on the judging day because we all met up from 9 till 4 and we stayed in one room until we came up with a decision about these books. The long list was determined differently, so we each picked our 12 favourite books and emailed them to the convening judge, which was Brenda Walker, and she compiled the long list. And of course, both Charlotte's book and Peggy's book were on all our long lists of the five judges. So why we chose these two books, firstly, that they were in the top three of almost everyone's lists and even in the short list as well. I'll start with Charlotte's book first, because Charlotte's book seemed to be like nothing we'd ever read before. Firstly, it was a satire. When we think about satire these days, you know, you think of humour, you think of irony. This is satire in the old-fashioned sense of the word. It subverts genres and it subverts, it subverts tropes. It's a very subversive book, and it accords, with what the Stella Prize is all about. It's a book that's very pivotal about women's issues, and yet there's a dark, seedy sense of humour about it, and you know. To be honest, this was a book that a few of the judges read and thought, oh gosh, this is the most horrific thing we've ever read.
And in a good way.
In an excellent way, in a very good way, it stayed with us because we had to read 170 books. A lot of the books blended in if they were similar genre, if they were similar themes, but this book stayed with us. The atrocities in it, the description you'll come to when you read this book of this doll that's built out of dead rabbits and pieces of skin, it's just a very vivid book. And just the sheer page-turning element of it. So it was a book I read quite quickly. It was a book that I read in one sitting. Peggy's book was the opposite. It wasn't controversial. It was an absolute crowd-pleaser. Everyone, not in a common way. It was just a book that had a lot of heart. So everyone loved it. Everyone. So this is the kind of book I could buy for my 13-year-old niece or the type of book I'd buy for my 70-year-old grandma. It was because the characters were so vivid, and the 13-year-old Silver was painted so realistically and so beautifully. She was almost like the scout of Australian literature. This is a book that's really going to endure. I reckon it will be studied in high schools and it will become a classic. So these were the reasons we picked these two books, and these two books were actually in the top two. It was very hard to decide.
Well, thank you for articulating that so beautifully, Alice. Apart from being a lot of work, are there any other observations you brought about? Were there any sort of common themes or things that kept resonating? If you had to sort of characterise something about the year of women's writing in 2015, I know that's a really broad generalisation, but were there any themes that a lot of you, that you or your fellow judges sort of kept saying, kept coming back, or kept coming up again?
So there was this great theme of Australian dystopias. And the consummate example, of course, is Charlotte's book, but, you know, Australian landscapes burning, Australian landscapes collapsing. That was one of the main themes, you know, and this was echoed in a book called Anchor Point as well by Alice Robinson. Another very strong theme was the theme of the relationship between parents and their children, as in Hope Farm, in quite a number of the books on our short list and our long list as well. But... you know, one of the things that we tried to look for as judges was we tried to transcend, you know, the publication. So we didn't care whether it was published by Penguin Random House or if it was published by a small press called Seizure. We looked at all the books quite equally. And one of the most difficult things was that there were quite a few excellent memoirs. Now, the Stella Prize, the three criteria we judged the books by was excellent, engaging and original. And so many memoirs, including Magda Stavansky's and quite a few others of quite diverse backgrounds, were excellent and engaging. But a memoir is hard to write in an original way because it's a personal life story. So that was the trickiest part of judging the Stella Prize. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you. I thought we could talk now. There are quite a few commonalities across your two books. I was really struck as well, but I thought I'd just ask you to talk a little bit about the inspirations for them. Going back to you now, Peggy, I mean, is it autobiographical at all? I know that's an awful question to ask a novelist, and I kind of shame myself by asking it, but what is it about hippie communes, if you didn't grow up in one, that particularly interests you, or that sort of searching for utopia and then the sort of... you know, the disenchantment. I mean, silver is kind of the collateral damage of other people's ideals, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't grow up at all on a commune. My parents weren't hippies. I mean, my dad grew a beard in the 70s. My mum grew a melon, but everybody did. They were quite conservative. But I do have a fascination with that sort of hippie dream, that aspect of Australian counterculture during the 70s. And I also have a real... just passion, and I think it's almost from an aesthetic point of view with the 70s. I was born in the mid-70s, so I don't really remember the 70s, but I feel like that era, it's in me. You know, it's the photos in my family photo albums are taken then. My parents were at their prime then. You know, it's... I was drawn to that sort of background. And then... so that was sort of there as the kind of... what do you call it? The canvas. And then... as with all my writing, the characters arrived and the dynamic between the characters, and I knew it was going to be about a mother and a daughter and that they had this difficult relationship. And I think if you were to say that this book was in any way autobiographical, and I think all writing is in some ways, you know, as we would probably all agree, I drew on my experience of being... I am a mother and I am a daughter, and my relationship with my mother and my own child or children is nothing like this relationship here, but I think with all of my writing I draw on true experiences, and then they are extrapolated out and exploded out and made really big and presumably more interesting than my own experience, I hope. And I guess the idea with writing is that you have enough of the personal experience in there, which is quite universal. There's enough of a connection between that and the extrapolated bigger stories that readers can relate. So does that answer your question?
It does. I mean, did you do any research into communes?
Oh, yeah, I did a lot. So there's actually two voices in this book. There's the main voice, which you heard a bit of before, which is Silver as an adult looking back on the year she was 13 and talking about what happened at Hope Farm. But then it's interspersed with her mother, Ishtar's voice, which is a very inarticulate voice, and it's she really can't write very well. Her grammar and her spelling is bad. And when I realised that I needed to have... I originally wrote the book all from Silver's perspective, but I realised that we needed to hear Ishtar's voice from her. And when I had figured out what her story was going to be, and I kind of don't want to give too much away about the book, but what I did draw on in constructing that voice was the stories of women who were involved in the Senate inquiry into forced adoption in Australia, which happened in about 2013 maybe. So it was when I was sort of working on this, it might have been a bit earlier. So it was in the news, Julia Gillard made a public apology to women who were forced to give up their babies by hospitals and by the government in Australia, by people who were working for the government. And you can read testimonials written by women who went through these experiences online, and I read heaps of those, and they are absolutely heartbreaking because these are people who are not necessarily articulate and they're not necessarily writers, but they are just telling their stories. And I got Ishtar's voice just came to me from that, of the voice of someone who is really giving you a raw experience of something very traumatic. And yeah, and plus I watched lots of YouTube videos of old footage of communes from the 70s, which was just
any
very
excuse.
Pleasant, and I loved it.
Can I just say, one of the judges, when we were locked in that room all day to judge, managed to convince all of us that you were a child of hippies and you'd grown up in a commune. They were so convinced that, and they said, this is a generation that's finally had a voice. And
oh, wow. I'm the what was her
so
name?
So we're convinced Demigenko you
of
grew, up, yes. grew up in Nimbin somewhere and you had this personal experience.
No, I made it all up.
Oh, wow, that's a big surprise to me and to the other judges when they find out.
So there was one judge who actually read this as a memoir. You realised that, Peggy? So I also know from a few things I've heard you say, Charlotte, and read about your book, that you did, your book is based on some historical research and actually came out of the, you know, an actual real prison for girls that existed, I think, will tell us more, in Parramatta in the late 60s, 70s. Can you talk a little bit about how that was the inspiration behind your book? But actually, your book feels very contemporary in other ways. Mm. A lot of the references are much more contemporary.
Mm. Yeah, I heard one documentary and I went to one exhibition that, I don't know if you saw the Canberra, it was called Life in Children's Homes, and anyway, it was, I'll start from the beginning, sorry. The Hay Institution for Girls was a horrific prison in New South Wales that was operating in the 60s and 70s, and it was an offshoot of the Parramatta Girls' Home. And I heard a documentary on Radio National produced by Anne Arnold about a reunion of women who had survived Hay and were going back there for a weekend to see each other and sort of exercise some of the demons of things that had happened to them there. And this place was run by the state government, and it was created from a 19th century prison for adult men that had been decommissioned on the grounds that it was inhumane to keep adult men there. And there were some of the girls at the Parramatta Girls' Home caused a riot, and they were on the roof of the Parramatta home protesting about the conditions they were held in there. And then what were named the 10 worst girls in the state, that was what the government called them, were drugged and put on a train and taken out to Hay. And there they were made to do hard labour. They had to do things like build a path, a sort of crazy paving path, and then when they finished building it, they were told to smash it all up again. And they couldn't speak to each other. They had to be a certain distance from each other at all times. They had to march everywhere, and they were never allowed to look up from the floor. So this place was running when I was entering my own, not long before I entered my own adolescence, and the girls there were wayward, you know, what would be called wayward girls. Many of them, and I've since discovered that there are places like this in Victoria, in all, it seems to me now that our country was absolutely filled with hellish places to put young women particularly, and children. And they were just incarcerated there and then absolutely brutalised in the most horrific sadistic ways that I did not want to put in my book and didn't. So I was writing... So one of the reasons many of these girls were there is that they had been sexually assaulted by a father or, you know, someone in the community, and they told somebody about it. And they were then marched to a police station and charged with a charge called, I haven't got the wording right, but it's being in moral danger. that was a crime that they were charged with. It's so absurd. Mm. You can see why my book became a surreal kind of thing. And then they were locked up. So this, the thing that struck me as the kind of most terrible thing, I mean, there were so many terrible things, but the fact that they spoke, what they were punished for was speaking. And they were locked up, as I said. So I was writing this book. I started writing. I wanted to write about that for some reason. I didn't really understand because I didn't want to write about it. But that thing of being punished for speaking, it just sort of wouldn't let me go. And I started writing a book set in the 60s and 70s, and I didn't want to write about Hay particularly because many women had written their own testimonies of these places. And I didn't want to trample on what on their, you know, raw experience. And I had also the playwright Alana Ballantyne had written plays about Hay and Parramatta. And I just wanted to do something sort of separate from all of that. But I still was writing in a fairly naturalistic sort of style, and I, anyway, it just wasn't working. The writing was absolutely appalling. It was dead on the page, and nothing was working. And sometimes when that happens to me, I just think, well, try the opposite. You know, the George Costanza approach, I call it. where it works too. So I had it set in the past, so I thought, I'll set it in the future, just for today, you know, just to chuck it up and see what happens. And then, but also by this time I'd started to become aware of things that were happening in our culture now, of examples of women speaking about things and being punished for them. So one of the clear examples that I recall was the case of the young army cadet in New South Wales, who I'm sure you've all heard about that case. The bloke that she slept with broadcast their sex to his friends, etc. She spoke up about it. She was punished. The first act of the army was to discipline her in front of her peers, and then her peers vilified her, and she became known as that Skype slut. And that just filled me with so much rage when I heard about it. It was so, so clear who was right and who was wrong. And the punishment was so vicious, and it was of her. So that was just one thing. And then all the other things that we hear all the time, sort of football scandals and whatever, just started suddenly, was like light bulbs going off all around. So I started writing it set in a now or a future or a slightly altered contemporary world. And I started making the voice a little bit weird or making it a bit surreal so that I could sort of, I felt free then. The writing started to come alive in a way that hadn't been the case for, you know, a year, 2 years of writing this dead stuff.
Yeah.
I'll stop now.
No, that's what the book examines. And you also, I mean, the depressing thing is you seem to suggest that we haven't come very far from the 60s and 70s, that we've had a female prime minister and a female governor general, but in fact, what has changed? You still get shame, you know, victim blaming. You still get shame for speaking out.
And if you threaten male power, you really get punished. I mean, and that's what happened to Julia Gillard, in my view, and including the male power in her own party. That was so striking to me. So, it seems rife.
So what then seems so powerful about your book, and also I would say all these books in some ways, in fact, for me, one of the common themes, and that actually links in with Lorinda, and I want to talk a little bit about that, is that you make it very nuanced and complex, because there's also internalised misogyny. In all these books, women are complicit and girls are complicit in the ways that that their lives play out. So they don't, in the natural way of things, the women don't all band together and go, you know what, this is crazy, we could get out of here if we just fought back. As you say, you have a nurse who's not really a nurse, you have one woman who's colluding with the guards, but the women, in different ways, there's one very strong friendship, are actually working against each other a lot of the time, and there's one Hetty who sort of collaborates or goes off with one of the guards, and even towards the end, some of the women are sort of won over by pretty feminine things again. You think, have we learnt nothing? And so I was wondering if that was something which resonated, Alice, with you when you read The Natural Way of Things, because if you could talk a bit in Lorinda, how the cabinet, so in a girls' school, how girls are actually still policing each other, girls. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about your book?
Oh, sure. So that was a recurring theme, again, in this year's 2016 Stella Prize, was the use of power and how power plays out. And what was compelling to all the judges about Charlotte's book was this nuanced complexity. So the women were self-misogynistic. They vied, against each other for the attention. And what was so fascinating was for the attention of these two men who were quite paltry and puny and incompetent. So their jailers were these two incompetent, guards who had a mean statistics streak. But if they all banded together, they probably could have throttled them, but they didn't. And, this sounds funny, but when I read it, the reason the book was so horrific and so excellent is from my own family experience, my father was in a collective of 5,000 people. They had 12 teenagers, literally teenagers, 12 to 16-year-old in charge of this collective. And these teenagers could do anything to them. They would have mass executions where they'd tie adults' hands behind their backs and wrap a plastic bag over your head. You think 5,000 people, 12 teenagers and maybe 5 or 6 adults, how do these things happen? And so on a much broader level, not just about feminism or misogyny, these books really speak to the heart of how power plays out. And that was such a fundamental truth I found in Charlotte's book.
And in your book, because I would like you to say
no,
about
it. I don't want to talk about
it. You don't want to put you back to class. So
it
modest.
It was so 2015.
Oh, it's so such old news. Fair enough. I still urge you to read Lorinda because I will talk for you. That is power within a girls' school and how that operates too. Mm. And I wonder, Peggy, in yours, because equally you have a tremendous sympathy for Ishtar, the mother. But, sometimes you just want to shake her as well. Her passivity sometimes was just, falling for the next man who took her off to the next commune and then, took her money or just... So I wondered if you would defend her more than you got annoyed with her or how you felt about that she was actually... because she was limiting her daughter's life and her aspirations and her education and... So it was a very nuanced portrayal too.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said the word nuanced because... Sometimes I wonder whether I had a very clear perspective with Ishtar because I actually felt tremendous compassion for her. And I think that does perhaps just go back to that idea of everything you write comes from yourself. And I identified with her. I mean, I'm not like her. I haven't had the same life. But I think in order to create a character, you have to sort of imagine what their experience would have been. So, and there have been people who have... It's really made them not like the book at all, that character. And people have said things like, I couldn't believe that a mother would do that to her daughter. And so
I always find that so amazing when people say a mother wouldn't do that to their daughter. It's like, have you lived in the world?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and so I suppose that the task of a writer, if you're going to tackle this kind of subject matter, is to try and get into the nuance and to try and really flesh out that character. And I don't expect readers to forgive Ishtar for what she's done, but perhaps to be able to understand or appreciate how somebody could end up in that position. And she really was someone that she did love her child, and she meant well, and she tried. But it goes back to power, She in various different ways, she really just couldn't get a break, and she wasn't very well equipped in the first place. I think so. Anyway, we're sort of going into too much. I think I'm going into too much detail about the actual character, but. I don't know. You can't really question this stuff when you're writing because I think you would stop.
And
so
I think
you just it's a blind faith whether you...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think what makes Ishtar's character work is her voice. And I think that's a really literary thing that it's hard to explain. But as soon as you hear her voice on the page, you connect with her and sympathise with her. I did. I sympathised with her entirely and still thought she was hopeless as a mother. But that's what fiction is so good at, is showing you that two opposite things can be true at the same time. Mm, yeah. And that's why we read fiction, I think. We contain multitudes.
Yeah. And the other thing that's a very common theme, I'd say, between both is a love of the natural world and also the power of the landscape and the environment. And I wanted to ask you both, because I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, do either of you actually name exactly where they are? Yours is a made up...
I made up a town and I said Gippsland, and Gippsland, if you look on a map, is massive, so it could be really anywhere in Victoria, yeah.
So did you have a very strong sense of place and spending time in that place when you were writing it? And also there, for two characters, especially for Silver and Ian, the bush gives them a lot of solace. Is that something you can relate to?
Yeah, so Ian's a boy who lives on a neighbouring property who Silver makes friends with. They're sort of two misfits. I didn't have a specific real place, but I spent almost all of my childhood holidays on Phillip Island, where my grandparents had a holiday house, and so we would be shipped off there pretty much all the time. And I loved it. I mean, I love it. And ironically, my partner, when I met him, said, "Hey, I've got a place at Phillip Island." And I was like, "Well, what? You're kidding." So now I'm still spending all my time there and subjecting my children to it. But because, you know, by the time I was 16, I was like, "God, this is the most boring place in the world. I'm never coming back here." And then here I am back there. But there's something about that Victorian... So, you know, Phillip Island, it's in Port Phillip Bay. It's off... it's Western Port Bay. God. And it's, you know, Gippsland is just above, just off... Like, and it's, you drive over a bridge, it's not far away from the landscape that I imagine we would go on day trips and things, but it's that landscape of it's bright, it's glittering, it's windy, and it's freaking cold in the winter because we would spend our winter holidays at the island as well, because our parents had to go to work or whatever and send us off to our grandparents. So and I've got I really did want to evoke that. But I did make up the creek and the actual setting of the farm, and the town is, I guess, you could drive through many towns like that around Victoria.
And what about you, Charlotte? Were you actually, did you have a very, in your head, do you know where it is?
No, it's a completely imagined place, but I've spent a lot of time, I grew up in a little country town called Cooma, which is not remote at all, but we spent a lot of time in the bush and whatever and had friends on farms, and I still have, I wrote quite a bit of the book staying at a friend's farm in the sort of central west of New South Wales. So I feel that I have a strong sense of being in a landscape myself, and I just sort of pulled in all kinds of memories and images, and I looked at a lot of images actually of landscapes and of sort of broken down farm buildings and shearers' quarters. And my girls, they're locked up in these, what they call them, dog boxes, but they're the old shearers' quarters. But some of the images I saw of old shearers' quarters, like, oh, my God, these are like hell holes. So, that wasn't hard making that up.
And Yolanda, one of the characters, really has a strong connection. And also, it literally saves them because she finds food, but it saves her psychologically and spiritually too. Are you someone who takes yourself out of the city to, I don't know, to...
I do
to
find...
be rejuvenated?
The natural world a very... a redemptive force, and it is a redemptive force in my book. But I try and get out, and we have a little spot we go sort of pseudo camping at, and there's a little hut on this property not far from Sydney, and it's just beautiful. And I did a lot of, I spent a week editing the book there, and it's very rustic little, you know, there's like one room really, and you sleep in tents and stuff, but being alone in that natural space was really powerful, actually.
Mm. That's just made me think. I actually spent time while I was working on Hope Farm at two different residencies that were both in rural settings, and I think being able to do the writing in the inner setting like that is fantastic.
Well, and the kind of sounds and everything you get into.
Yeah, and it ties in a little bit to the theme of prizes and being awarded something where you're given time and space, because they were both sort of fellowships. And
so part of for the shortlist this year, the Stella Prize, the shortlistees get some money, but they also get a 3-week writing retreat at a house down in Point Addis on the Victorian coast. And it sounds like you are both writers who actually would use that. Being told to go away and write isn't actually a scary thing.
Maybe we're going to get six books set on a
beach. Maybe we are. With very similar landscapes and animals. And
I thought that was the most beautiful, beautiful gift to have on a shortlist. That was so moving to know that you were being given this really special... 3 weeks, for a start, is for most writers to get away for that
incredible.
Long and to be able to afford to go away and stay somewhere for that long is sort of really unheard of. And to have your travel expenses paid is incredible. So... I think that's a very beautiful thing to have done. Thank you.
Pass that on to the donor who's organised that for us. Mm-hmm. We could keep going. I want to just talk a bit about Charlotte's speech, which I urge you to go and read. I'm sure many of you in the room has read Charlotte's prize night speech, which is incredible. But in that, you make a very impassioned plea for the value and importance of art and literature. and I'm just going to read a little bit. You say, "It often feels to me that we have entered a new dark age, an age in which science is rejected in favour of greed and superstition, in which our planet is in desperate need of rescue, an age in which bigotry and religion are inseparable and presidential candidates promise to punish women for controlling their own bodies. I feel that in the midst of this gloom, we need art more than ever. Art is a candle flame in the darkness. It urges us to imagine and inhabit lives other than our own, to be more thoughtful, to feel more deeply, to challenge what we think we already know." And it is, that is an incredible case for literature. But you also have talked about in your speech, and I know you've done a lot of work for advocacy for the Literature Board, about how artists these days earn so little from their writing and from their art. Could you talk a little bit about the statistics you found out and really what we should do from here? Like, how can we, you know, what is the solution?
Tell us, Phil.
Yeah, please.
Yes. I've got the solution. Didn't I tell you? Oh, okay, I'll tell you the solution. No, the solution is buy books, actually. That's what the solution is. But, I quoted a couple of statistics from a study done by Macquarie University's economics department last year. The one I quoted was about literary fiction, which is what Peggy and I write, and the average income from royalties for literary fiction is $4,100 a year. But that's the average. So that is quite skewed by the few people who earn well. And most literary fiction writers I know wouldn't earn anywhere near that from their books per year. They might get an advance of maybe $9,000 or $10,000 for a book that's taken 3, 4, 5 years to write. So that's one thing. The average income for all writers is, I think, $12,900 a year. But the writers who are doing well are people writing educational books and genre fiction, and all power to them. But again, that skews the average quite a lot. One of the other figures was that 95% of all writers in Australia earn beneath the average wage. And the study that I'm a bit more familiar with is the previous one, and the figures have really hardly shifted and perhaps gone down in some ways. When I was at the Australia Council, the figure I was quoting was that the median income from creative practice was $3,600 a year. So that means that half of all authors earn underneath that. Half earn more, half earn less. And obviously, you cannot survive on that kind of money. Arts funding is being continually slashed by the federal government. It's kind of good that I don't work at the Australia Council anymore, because now I can talk about this stuff. All the jobs of all the art form chairs were axed, partly as a funding measure, and a lot of staff lost their jobs. And that is as it should be, because the artists are the ones really losing. And we're about to see the results of those cuts start to kick in, because people are going to find out in the next couple of weeks, I think, with lots of small company, you know, theatre companies, writers, visual artists, everybody is finding out that they are getting a lot less money. And I don't know what the solution is, because, well, the solution is for us as a society to give a shit about art and literature and talk about it and demand it from our politicians. There was so much excitement, I think, when Malcolm Turnbull got the prime ministership, to think, well, he does in this sort of, in our world, because he has shown in the past that he does care about the arts. But that has, there's been no evidence of that so far, and the cuts have, the money that was taken from the Australia Council has not been returned, and now the money that was taken is being used really very, it seems very evident that it's being used for as pork barrelling, election campaigning, being given at the whim of the minister with no, there's no published criteria about how this money is to be distributed. It sort of comes and goes. The grants are suddenly announced that nobody's really, you can apply sort of any time, but we don't know when and how and what for. So I think the Victorian state government is much more generous than, I mean, the New South Wales state government's arts funding is so pitiful that, you know, I wouldn't have a clue what it is for writers, but I think there used to be one, I think, $20,000 grant or something for all writers in New South Wales from the state government. So we don't go there for money. But The other thing that's happening to writers all the time, and I will shut up in a minute, but this gets me fired up, is that we are now asked to write for free and work for free all the time. So I know one of the great things about the Wheeler Centre is that it pays people who speak here. Most times when you see a writer speaking, or a lot of the time, they're unpaid, and the person interviewing them is unpaid. And if, you know, we all do it for each other when we have a new book out or whatever, and that's sort of okay, but if... that is work. That if you're chairing a session like this, and a lot of writers do this, it's sort of at least a week's work. You've got to read all the books. And you might, at a writer's festival, get $200 for that. Lots of writers put a lot more energy into that. Talking about your own book is, you know, I don't find that a problem, not being paid for that. But then you want to make sure that there are book sales alongside that. And I would urge anyone who goes to a festival, hears a writer speak, and you get something from what they say, buy a book, buy their book, buy somebody else's book. You know, a lot of people are really happy to spend $25 on a bottle of wine, but think, oh, that's a bit, you know, I can't really afford to buy a book. Like, well, you have to. You have to afford it.
Hey, hey.
Thank you.
Yeah, really. We are going to open up for questions. Just while you're thinking about questions, I've just got one thing that Alice and I wanted to talk about very quickly, which is that one of the noticeable things about the longlist this year was, especially even compared to last year in the shortlist, was the lack of cultural diversity in the Stella longlist. But the judges could only judge on what the books that were entered. And I know, Alice, we've talked a bit about this, and you wanted to just address about it.
It was very difficult. Also, you know, I'm a writer of diverse background, so I was particularly looking for diverse books, not in an affirmative action sense, because we judge the book according to the three criteria. But the interesting thing I noticed was that the books by writers of colour or writers of a different cultural background almost all seemed to be exclusively memoirs, or they were writers who couldn't get published in Australia, so were published in America, writing genre fiction or writing science fiction or writing interesting stories about vampires. This says a lot about our publishing industry in Australia. In fact, my friend Maxine Bennett-Beclark had a very difficult time getting her best-selling book, Foreign Soil, published because people in the literary industry kept telling her, look, write a memoir first. No one wants to read short stories. Essentially, that was what they told her. And she has published, you know, rejection slips on Facebook telling us, saying similar things. And she stuck to her guns, and she entered her first book of short stories into the Victorian Premier's Literary Prize. Now, the literary community of Australia, especially Victoria, are very open-minded. They're not going to care about your race or culture as long as it's a wonderful piece of work. And that's why it's so important to have diversity on panels like the Stella Prize and open-minded judges. And that's why it's important to have, you know, we had a lot of excellent memoirs, but we thought, oh, look, these memoirs could have just got a step further if the publishers weren't so rushed. If they had spent maybe 6 more months, a year in editing this, this would have tweaked it from, you know, really good to original, and it would have been a contender. So firstly, ethnics and people of colour don't just write memoirs. They're writing vampire stories, they're writing science fiction. They're just not getting published in Australia. And secondly, it's so important to have judges on panels like this who are diverse and who think outside the square, who don't think like publishers and who don't think like, you know, some agents or people who are interested in the commercial side of things.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think we need more diverse voices being published. I would also argue publishing is a very white industry, and this has been a huge conversation that's happening in the States, and I think that needs to change too. I think the editors and the publishers and the gatekeepers, to get more books by people of colour published, we're going to have to get more people in the industry. Mm. We have gone over time, but we have some time for probably a couple of questions, and the ushers will find you if you put your hand up. Otherwise, I will just keep talking. Well, go on. While people think about this, the other thing that Charlotte's speech addressed was the dark place that writers can get to when you're writing a really difficult book, but that sort of when you hit the wall, strategies for keeping going. I'm sure there's writers in the room, given the interviews you did for many years, and also that you've said writing this book, there were times where you just went, I don't know if I can keep going, I don't know why I'm keeping going. What are the kinds of things that do keep you going, or that other writers have told you?
I edited this little magazine that I sort of invented for 3 years, and basically it was a chance for me to have a really good two-hour masterclass with a writer of my choice while I just pick their brain madly for 2 hours. And I used something from every single interview in the writing of this book. So I guess my interpretation is very eclectic. I'm trying to think what...
But you could say talking to other writers is one
talking way. To other writers, absolutely, is... I mean, a lot of the time you just need to hold your nerve, I think, and push through and push on. One tried and true one for me is just getting up and going for a walk. And there's all these great studies now about walking and creativity and how they just... Something about the walking and the not focusing on the book can unlock something, have a little breakthrough. Sleep as well. I've often had a lot of writers talk about writing first thing in the morning or having a sleep during the day, and that sort of liminal space between sleep and wake is your subconscious can be a bit more sort of alive. Like for me, really, that thing of just doing the opposite, just try it, often yields results. Sometimes you just have to wait, I think, for something. I think trusting your instinct is really important, because sometimes this isn't working. All logic tells me that I should chuck this book in the bin. But something in you feels really strongly that there's something worth pursuing here. So, I mean, I do think all writers actually find their own way in the end. And that's what I learned from those interviews mainly, is that, and so many of them said, oh, look, I know this is not how you're supposed to do it, but blah, blah, blah. And like Joan London, who's possibly my favourite Australian writer, said over and over again, oh, I don't do what you're supposed to do. I just do it like this. It's like, you know, Alice Munro says, you're amazing, so that
you're doing something right. And what about you, Peggy? What do you do when you've sort of hit a wall? And also, what did writing this book teach you, if anything, about writing?
Oh, my goodness. All the same things, really. walking, I get a lot out of walking. I could write from home because my kids are all at school now, but I do walk to another location that's only 10 minutes away, but that space, often things will just float to the surface of my brain. I think something that I've got better at over time is knowing when to show other people my work and who to show it to. So I have trusted readers, but some of them I know are not good people to get feedback on something when it's in a very early stage, I am so sensitive to criticism. It's awful. My poor partner, he just says he just can't say anything. Like if I ask him to read anything that I've written, he gets this expression where he goes, "Yeah, it's great," and I'm like, "But surely, you know, haven't you got anything else to say?" And he goes, "No,
it's a trap. Don't answer."
Yeah, exactly, it's a trap. So yeah, just I mean, I guess all of that is just getting to know yourself. And. And I think like Charlotte said, just keep going, and also forgive yourself and be accepting of the ridiculous and circuitous process that is writing a book, because all of that stuff that Joan London's saying about, oh, I'm not doing it the right way, I think, well, I mean, there probably are writers who don't feel that way, who, you know, put on their silk smoking jacket and sit down and bang out a book and don't ever question themselves. But I question myself incessantly and drive myself insane. And I think at the end of it, you've got to go, well, that's my process, you know, and accept it. Yeah.
And Alice, I'm going to make you answer this question. But before we end, I'd like everyone to at least say something about the book they're working on now and the next book. And I know you can talk about...
Oh, you're such a publisher, Avita.
I am such a publisher. And I'll be signing you up later. So, Alice, I know you can say something about the books you're working on. One is my first lesson. So tell us a little bit.
Oh, okay.
She's so
just helping her along here.
So after Lorinda came out, I'm editing an anthology of young people's writing. So, you know, mainly students in high school, about their first lesson. It could be a school lesson. It could be a lesson at home. And we're just calling for submissions, which are due at the end of April. And we're compiling them together into an anthology about, you know, surviving your school days.
Great, thank you, Alice. There you go. I do know she's publishing that book. Peggy, can you say anything about the next
Well, it's in such an early stage, I don't know that I can. Except that I can say, this is, I wonder
she did laugh
if my agent is here, because I had a meeting with her recently and I said the terrible words, collection of short stories, and she kind of got all twitchy. But it's a book. It might be stories, but they might not. They might be linked.
Very nice. So funny. They might be chapters.
I've got a great story about Tegan Bennett-Daylight, who wrote the most beautiful collection of short stories, which is on the short list called Six Bedrooms, and you have to read it. It's brilliant. Years ago, she was at a dinner. We were both at a dinner, and she was sitting next to a publisher, and the publisher said, "So what are you working on?" And she'd written novels before this. And she said, "What are you working on now?" And she said, "I'm working on some short stories." And she said, the face just fell. And the woman said, "Are they linked?" It was the only hope. And they're not, all of them. And they're bloody amazing, and they're getting huge attention. So go, short story writers.
And Charlotte, you can't get away from answering that.
I'm starting a new novel about... It's part of my do the opposite strategy. So this book was about young women, and now I'm writing about old women. And I sat next to another publisher recently, and he said, "Oh, so what are you working on?" And I said, "Oh, a book." And my publisher, Jane Pulverman, said, "Oh, it sounds fantastic." And I said, "It's about these three old women." And he just went, "Oh." And I thought, "I'm going to show you, pal."
Aye, you are.
So, and yeah, it's about a friendship between several women in their late 70s.
I think it sounds fantastic. So we will show them. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panel tonight.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.